building community. If leadership is not about you, then who is it about? It's about them. It's about the amazing group of people who have come together under a common purpose or cause. They want to accomplish something, something that they can't accomplish by themselves. In order to get from here to there, it will require leadership, your leadership. You not only get to point them toward the goal, you get to guide them on the path that gets them there. You get to create the kind of atmosphere, vibe, and culture that this group of people will exist in along the way. If you coach a basketball team, you know that practice is an important part of the journey toward a championship. If you are the president of a club, you know that your weekly meetings are an important part of the journey toward successful events. If you oversee a group of people at work, you know that anything you can do together outside of work will enhance the journey towards your success at work. Lloyd Alexander said, "The journey is the treasure." Somewhere between here and there, those you lead can become something more than a group of individuals trying to accomplish a goal. They can become something better together than they ever could be alone. They can become a community. Wearing the same t-shirt doesn't make a group of people a team. Building community doesn't happen just by being in the same room together. It takes an intentional effort on the part of everyone. As the leader, you create space and opportunity for community to happen. I can tell if a group is moving toward community by the way they set up the chairs. Some groups set the chairs up in rows. Rows create audiences. Some groups set the chairs up in circles. Circles create community. There's a deep need in all of us. It is more powerful than the need to achieve. It's the need to belong. You can't force community. You can't make people like each other. You can't demand that everyone trust the person sitting next to them. There is no quick formula to achieve community. But there are certain elements that will encourage community to take place. There is a way to tap into the need to belong that we each possess. Number one, time. Community takes time. It doesn't happen in a moment, but occurs with the accumulation of moments. This is why you need to find space and time for the group to focus on the people they work with, apart from the work itself. The question is, how are you creating space in the schedule for your group to build relationships? Number two, vision. Community grows as people work toward a common purpose or goal. A team is not just a group of people. A team is a group of people who own the same dream for a better future. They are all headed in the same direction. People are more apt to work together if they know that those around them have committed themselves to the same effort. The question is, what are you doing to communicate the vision with clarity on a regular basis? Number three, sacrifice. The willingness of individuals to sacrifice their own time, resources, and energy for the good of others builds community. Selfishness is one of the greatest barriers to growing community. Apathy is a close second. Sacrifice is contagious. When one person gives something up for the good of another, it inspires the same in others. The question is, how can you acknowledge and celebrate the sacrifices group members make for each other? Number four, interdependence. The sense of community builds as people find themselves interdependent on others in the group. Interdependence is defined as a mutually supportive relationship. It is greater than mere dependence and develops through a maturing trust in one another and a willingness to risk vulnerability. People open up to one another, becoming more authentic and transparent with the others in the group. Interdependence creates a strong connection and commitment amongst group members. They accept and embrace one another. They find ways to celebrate their individuality while transcending their differences. This is what carries them through the difficult times. The question is, are you working towards something so challenging that it requires group members to be interdependent on each other in order to achieve it? Number 5, conflict. If you are a leader who wants to create community with those around you, you won't shy away from conflict. You will work through it because you know it is a necessary building block of community. The strongest communities walk through conflict together. Conflict is necessary to move beyond superficiality. Community is formed and strengthened as a group of people learn to disagree and debate gracefully. In the midst of problems and differences, they seek resolution by listening to each other and respecting one another. Conflict tests a group's ability to commit to struggle together rather than against one another. The question is, how will you guide the group through conflict and disagreements? When a leader truly understands the power of community, the idea of leader becomes less about a certain person or position and more about the spirit of the group. Everyone takes responsibility and commits to lead through their unique contribution and giftedness. Leadership becomes something that is embraced by each member of the community at different levels and at different times. It's the power of the community that has the greatest influence on the decisions that need to be made and the course of action necessary to move forward. Me or we? There is a difference between the leader who is all about me and the leader who is all about we. I created 2 lists of words to describe those differences. Between me or we, which words best describe your style of leadership? Selfish or selfless? Control or collaborate? Alone or together? Yours or ours? Fearing or trusting? Protect or provide? Egotistical or empathetic? Versus you or values you? Exclusive or shared? Take credit or give credit? Finite or infinite? Leadership starts with you, but it's not about you. It's about us, or rather it's about we. Instead of focusing on what can you do for me, the focus shifts toward what can I do for you? Delegation. You can't do everything by yourself and call yourself a leader. If you do everything by yourself, you aren't a leader. You're a worker. One of the best ways to determine if you're more of a worker or a leader is to look at where you focus your time and attention. The worker primarily focuses on tasks. The leader primarily focuses on people. I'm not saying a worker is bad and a leader is good. Both are necessary. Both are important. In fact, you might be a great worker, but that's not what you were elected or selected to be. You were given an opportunity because those around you needed a leader. So how do you focus primarily on people? It means you look for ways to get others involved. You create space and you create opportunity. You don't try and do all the tasks by yourself. You look for people who can jump in and help. You start to function like a leader when you give part of the work away. You let go of some of the tasks and empower others to complete them. You allow others to share in the responsibility of the work that needs to get done. If you're behaving like a worker, it's time to change your perspective. You need to begin to see your role as a leader. This means you need to delegate. And delegation can be a tricky issue for any leader. The word delegation is derived from Latin and means to send from. Think about it. You are taking the time to send the work from you to someone else. Delegation is defined as giving others the authority to act on your behalf, accompanied with the initial responsibility and accountability for results. It's a process where you give someone else an opportunity to take on a task or project. The thing that makes delegation unique is that it is an opportunity that is offered, never demanded. Great delegation lies somewhere between trying to hold on to every detail, unable to give anything away, versus being completely absent and lazy, avoiding any sense of responsibility for the work of others. In that wonderful in-between place lies the chance to offer others expanded responsibilities with a safety net. You are involved in the process. Handled effectively, delegation allows others to grow in their experience and not live in the fear of failure. If you're in a leadership role, you can delegate as much or as little of your work as you please. The thing about delegation is you still retain the ultimate responsibility for the completion of the work. Delegation simply allows you to pass the authority on as necessary to complete a task or project, but the obligation to see it completed still rests on the shoulders of you. A lot of leaders, who are actually workers, will shy away from delegation because they're afraid someone will say no. This fear is one of the reasons we think it's easier to do it all by ourselves. Another reason we might not delegate certain tasks is because we don't want to give up control, or maybe it's because we can't figure out who to ask. Simply put, workers will do where leaders will delegate. I've compiled some delegation wisdom you can apply to your leadership. Improving your delegation skills will improve your effectiveness as a leader. Use this list of 25 things to develop your own philosophy and process for delegating work to others. Number 1. Look at delegation as an opportunity for growth. Others grow through the process. Your leadership grows as you focus more on people than tasks. Number 2. Delegation provides you with more time to work on projects that only you, as the leader, should be working on. Number 3. Delegation is more meaningful when others see the benefit of completing a task. Number 4. When you describe the outcome you are hoping for, you allow people to use their creativity more than if you provide a step-by-step guide to completion. Number 5. Clarify any limits a person may have with completing a task or project. Let them know the extent of the authority you're giving them. Number 6. Delegated tasks done with excellence turn into greater opportunities for involvement, promotion, and recognition in the future. Number 7. Delegation exercise. Make a list of all of the activities you do on a regular or routine basis. Which ones can someone else do? Number 8. Challenge others to reach their potential when delegating. Encourage them to stretch their capabilities. Expect them to succeed, and you will be pleasantly surprised more frequently than not. Number 9. Teach those you delegate to be problem solvers and not problem reporters. If someone reports a problem, expect them to come up with 2 or 3 solutions to consider as well. Number 10. Smaller tasks should be given to someone to prove he or she is capable. Larger tasks or complete projects should be given to someone who has proven he or she is responsible. Number 11. Talk about what an outcome of excellence looks like at the beginning. Don't surprise people with evaluation they weren't planning for. Clearly define objectives and outcomes in measurable terms. Expectations must be lined out at the beginning. Number 12. You can delegate a task to someone and he or she can say no. Number 13. Delegate the parts of your position that you are weak in to others who have strengths in that area. Number 14. Delegation has a dark side. It might take longer. You might actually have done it better yourself. But leadership doesn't take back a delegated item for that reason. Part of your leadership responsibility is helping others learn to do it better. Number 15. Don't surprise people by checking in randomly. Let them know up front how often you plan on asking for updates and keep communication lines open. Number 16. Delegation strengthens your leadership. It shows you are doing your job by getting others involved and getting results with and through others. Number 17. When you delegate, there is always the risk that someone will make a mistake, but people often learn the most from the mistakes they make. Leaders aren't as upset by mistakes as much as repeated mistakes. Since we all make mistakes, help people to learn and grow from them. Number 18. Delegation happens most effectively when you match the requirements of the assignment with the talents of the person. Number 19. People have greater buy-in and invest more effort when they feel the freedom to use their own creative ideas and energy to accomplish a delegated task than if a supervisor tells them how to do it. Number 20. Delegation exercise. Who are three people you could ask to assist you with a project you're working on? Number 21. Effective delegation requires mutual trust. You trust the capabilities of others. They trust that they are doing something meaningful and significant. Number 22. Follow up, follow up, follow up. Don't hand off the project or task and then ask about it the day before it's due. Number 23. Set expectations, responsibility, outcomes, resources, and accountability in place. Try not to step in when someone faces a problem. Allow others to learn from their experience. You will be tempted to step in too soon. Number 24. Asking for help doesn't mean you're helpless. It gives someone else the chance to be helpful. And finally, number 25. Delegation exercise. Here are some great questions to ask at your first follow-up meeting. Is there anything I can do for you? Are there any questions you have? Are there any tools you need? Does everything about this make sense? The T in team stands for trust. I walked into the room full of newly elected student leaders. You could feel the excitement. You could sense that each one of them was motivated to do his or her very best. They all wore the same t-shirt. They were all on the same team. The only question that remained between their success or failure as a group was a simple one. Would they learn to trust each other? Every new year is full of excitement and anticipation. But the one big difference between the teams that overcome the obstacles and the ones who get blown apart by the barriers is found in one basic characteristic: trust. Trust is the foundation of effective teams. Patrick Lencioni, in one of the best leadership books for teams, The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, states the following. Remember, teamwork begins by building trust, and the only way to do that is to overcome our need for invulnerability. You may have charisma, outstanding talents, the ability to communicate well, and the most capable team on the planet. But if the people on your team don't trust you or trust each other, you'll never achieve the things you set out to accomplish. Inspire trust and you'll increase morale. Trust reduces frustration and skepticism. Where there is trust, teams tend to stay together. When there is no trust, teams tend to fracture. Trust will raise the level of your team's effectiveness. Wearing the same jersey or uniform doesn't guarantee trust. Trust is not automatic. It doesn't come with the title you were elected or selected to bear. You must earn trust from day one and every day after that. Here are six ways I believe you can earn and build trust with others. They are not quick fix remedies. It's not about doing it once. These are lifestyle behaviors that will earn the trust of teammates. Each one is a pathway to greater trust when used properly. Number one, be vulnerable. I'm always amazed at the response I get when I share my biggest mistakes with other people. I don't do it for pity. I do it because I want people to know who I am and who I am becoming as a result of the mistakes I've made. Patrick Lencioni talks about the value of vulnerability later in his book. Great teams do not hold back with one another. They are unafraid to air their dirty laundry. They admit their mistakes, their weaknesses, and their concerns without fear of reprisal. When I am real and authentic with people, they are more willing to be open and honest with me about where they are at in life. People aren't looking for a leader who is perfect. They're looking for one who is honest. Number two, take responsibility for the consequences of team decisions. Responsibility is the greatest requirement of leadership. When a decision goes right, the leader should be quick to praise the people around him or her who helped make it happen. When a decision goes wrong, the first person to take responsibility should be the leader. Point the finger at yourself at the point of failure, and you will earn the respect of those around you. So many people want to place blame on anyone and anything other than themselves. A leader who takes responsibility for both decision and consequence is rare. Number three, coach people up, not down. When you witness someone making a mistake or moving in a wrong direction, you have a choice in how you'll respond. You can berate or belittle this person, or you can inspire and motivate this person to do better. We have all been under the guidance of someone who pushed us to do our best without making us feel inferior. Every time you correct someone, you have the opportunity to increase their belief in themselves as well as improve their behavior. Number four, respond well to failure. Whether you like it or not, you are an example to others. You get to choose each day what type of example you will be. Your example shines through in both success and failure. Everyone will experience failure. That includes you. Once you admit that, it's only a matter of deciding how you will respond to your failures. A healthy response involves acknowledging the failure and learning from what went wrong. When you constantly repeat the same failure over and over, it only tells us that you're not paying attention. When you respond appropriately to your failure, you give those around you permission to learn from their failure. If you try to hide your failure, you only frustrate those around you who are well aware and wish you'd been more honest with them and with yourself. Number five, make room for discussion, not division. I hope you haven't created a team of people who agree on everything and see life from the same perspective as you. If that's the case, you've put together a very boring and myopic team. When you gather people of diverse viewpoints and ideas, you create opportunities for innovation and immense creativity. Different perspectives can be a great asset if you don't allow them to divide your team. That's why it's important to create space for discussion. You want to allow people to be heard and appreciated. If your first response is to judge others because their view is different than your own, you will limit the potential of your team. You will know that you have begun to build trust on your team when you move from acknowledging the differences between each member and begin appreciating those differences and what they contribute to the team. Number six, find the gold. Having lived in Northern California for a period of my life, I know a little bit about mining for gold. It is a tedious process. As in most mining efforts, you have to move a lot of dirt. Nobody is looking for or celebrating the dirt because there is so much of it. The goal is to find the gold. Effective leaders recognize the special and unique giftedness in each person. Every person can make a contribution. Your job is to find ways to incorporate these gifts for the betterment of the team and the accomplishment of your goals. People can grow frustrated by a lack of progress or improvement, but you are on the lookout for those glimpses of greatness and potential in others. Sometimes those in your team can't see past all of the dirt in their lives. The dirt is the mundane, ordinary, average, and day-to-day stuff that keeps us from reaching our true potential. You will earn their trust when they see you are dedicated to pointing out the potential that lies hidden within them. The T in Team stands for Trust, Part 2. Maybe you've heard this one. Question: Why should you never trust the world's fastest animal? Answer, because he's a cheetah. I know, it's a corny joke, but it helps me make my point, which justifies putting the joke in the book. There are behaviors that build trust, and there are behaviors that kill trust. Cheating is a trust killer. If you get caught cheating, lying, stealing, deceiving, or doing something similar to these, trust is broken. It can happen in a moment. But there are behaviors that build trust. These take time. They are daily investments in the trust bank. The key here is consistency. Number one, go first. Going first is often seen as a leadership trait. You go first to set an example. You gain influence as you provide an example worth following. You model what trust looks like when you step into the circle of trust before anyone else. You set the example for others by being the first to extend trust. It takes courage and vulnerability to trust someone else. That's what makes it so powerful when it happens. Trust helps a team accomplish so much more than they could without it. But it's fragile. It's not based on certainty. Much like faith, trust is a risk. Your example demonstrates that trusting each other is worth the risk. Your example sets the tone and begins to model a culture that values trusting one another. It can be as simple as looking across the table at the members of your team and telling them, "I trust you." It's in our nature to respond positively to positive input. So if someone tells you, "I trust you," there's something that clicks inside of us, making us more likely to trust that person. Think of it as inner reciprocation. Of course, it works the opposite way as well. Tell someone, "I don't trust you," and I'm pretty sure that person will lean toward not trusting you either. This same phenomenon occurs when you tell someone you believe in them, or you depend on them, or you need them. People may not know what trust looks and feels like until you model it for them. When you go first, you put a picture in people's mind of a trusting person. You set the example for them to follow. Number two, be worth trusting. If the people on your team are going to go out on a limb for you, they have to decide if it's worth the risk. Every word, action, and behavior you demonstrate, especially in times of difficulty, will help or hinder another person's decision about whether or not to trust you. If you and I want to be trusted, we must honestly look at ourselves and ask, "Am I worth trusting?" Think of it this way. If I ask the people on your team who the most trusting person is on the team, would your name be mentioned? If not, why not? Trust takes time to build. It's earned in the same way one earns respect. People know where you stand. They recognize a consistent pattern to your life. In each and every interaction, the scales are slowly tipped in favor of trust. People see you as a reliable person and not a risky relationship. Trust is worth something. It's valuable. It takes an investment on both sides of the relationship. You choose to live in a trustworthy manner because you don't want to lose the trust others place in you as the leader. Once trust is lost, it's difficult to earn it back. Number three, take responsibility for the consequences of your choices. If I could define leadership in one word, besides the word leadership, it would be responsibility. The reason I choose that word is because I believe that's where leadership starts and ends. A person doesn't start off deciding to be a leader. A person begins by deciding to be responsible. Responsibility is also one of the most practical ways for you and I to build trust with those around us. A leader takes responsibility, first for him or herself, then for the good of others. I'll refer to Lencioni's words once more concerning trust and responsibility. What exactly does vulnerability-based trust look like in practice? It is evident among team members who say things to one another like, "I screwed up," "I was wrong," "I need help," "I'm sorry," and "You're better than I am at this." Most important, they only make one of these statements when they mean it, and especially when they really don't want to. I've seen it time and again. A leader takes responsibility at the front end of a project or cause, but when something goes wrong, he or she won't take responsibility for the consequences. Every choice has a consequence. We show we are worth trusting when we take responsibility for both the choice and the consequences of that choice. Take responsibility for the good of others. Leadership starts with taking responsibility. In the last chapter, I said a leader takes responsibility first for him or herself, then for the good of others. In other words, leadership starts with you, but it's not about you. It's about working for the good of others. Imagine the following scenario. You walk into your house and your mom or dad is standing over a broken lamp on the floor. They look at the lamp and then they look at you. Their eyes dart back and forth between the lamp and you. Their gaze is somewhat accusing. Their look is asking the unspoken question. But you've been gone all day. You don't know anything about the details of the broken lamp. So you speak up in the awkward silence with the response that every child has spoken since the dawn of time. I didn't do it. You don't want to be blamed for something you didn't do. You don't want to get involved in a mess that's not your fault. You shy away from anything that will put you in the middle of the situation. But that's not what leaders do. In fact, they do the opposite. They take responsibility. When you choose to be a leader, you forfeit your right to forfeit responsibility. You put your rights on hold and take responsibility. You willingly step into situations that need fixing, even though you did nothing to break them. You willingly move into matters that require the assistance of someone else. You willingly probe into problems that others are unwilling or unable to solve. Let's go back to the broken lamp. The initial response for most people focuses on themselves. I didn't do it. The leadership response is one of responsibility for the good of others. It says, how can I help you clean that up? Taking responsibility for the good of others is a willingness to be a part of the solution in the lives of others rather than the problem. When you begin to look at each situation through the lens of responsibility, you'll see opportunities to make a difference. You can impact any situation when you approach it with the mindset that you will, one, add value, and two, put the needs of others before your own. When you do both of those things, you grow your influence with others. It's when we take responsibility for the good of others that we truly earn the right to be called a leader. Not because we take that title for ourselves, but because others recognize it in us and choose to follow. Hero or Herm? I love a good superhero movie. I'm especially intrigued by the stories that show how an ordinary person becomes a superhero. Most superheroes are born out of necessity. There is a crisis that occurs that is too big for ordinary people to handle. It's a super problem that requires a superhero. When I'm training a group of students, I will often ask them a simple question. If you could have any superhero power you imagine, what would it be? The answers are typical. The ability to fly, to be invisible, super strength, super speed, and my favorite, the ability to pick a perfect melon in the produce section of the grocery store. I love asking this question because it gets everyone talking. Everyone can imagine what it would be like to have some type of superpower. Maybe that's why we love superhero movies so much. We all wonder what it would be like to do something extraordinary. As we share our answers to the question, I follow up by asking what people would do with their superpowers. Everyone begins to visualize how much easier their life would be if they had this special gift. They imagine how fun it would be to use their powers for themselves. They think about how much attention they would get. And this makes them all villains. When I state that out loud, the room grows quiet. Nobody wants to be the villain. But it's true. In every superhero movie, there is often a fine line between the hero and the villain. But you can figure it out pretty quickly which side of the line a person with superpowers stands on. The hero will always be the person who puts the needs of others before his or her own. The superhero uses his or her abilities for the good of others. The villains use their powers for the good of themselves. The words hero and leader have something in common. They are both titles given to someone by others. Real heroes, just like real leaders, don't start off trying to be those things. They simply took responsibility for needs other than their own. They made a sacrifice that turned ordinary into extraordinary. In the real world, none of us have much in the way of superpowers. We can't fly, we can't be invisible, and we can't see through walls. But that doesn't mean we're powerless. We are surrounded by need. There are problems that need solving. Where are our heroes? Perhaps this can be a phone booth moment for you. You just might be the person we need. You have been given abilities, resources, and perspectives you can use for the good of others. When you truly see that it's not about you, you are more ready to become the hero, H-E-R-O, those around you have been looking for. So I created an acrostic to demonstrate the potential each of us has to be a hero to the people and situations we encounter. H stands for help. You can make an immediate impact in any situation. Don't believe me? See what happens when you let these four words be the first thing out of your mouth. How can I help? Problems and difficulties tend to isolate us. People around you need to know they're not alone. Be helpful, and you'll break down barriers and build relationships. E stands for encourage. To encourage someone is to actually give them courage. You share courage because people have lost theirs and can't see past their problems. Despair and discouragement can blind those around you from knowing what they're capable of. They have the ability, but they lack the courage. Encouragement heals a faulty perspective. The letter R stands for rescue. We will always need heroes because there will always be people who need saving. Your leadership position is a platform. You can use the tools, resources, and influence at your disposal to make someone else's life better. Heroes don't run around looking for extraordinary moments to be heroic. They simply prepare themselves in the ordinary, day-to-day moments. When a need presents itself, they're ready to step in. We often hear someone who has been labeled a hero respond by saying, "I was just doing my job." Letter O stands for others. This is what ties the whole thing together. It is using your ability to help, encourage, and rescue for the good of others. That's what it means to be heroic. Don't believe me? When a person only helps himself, we call him selfish. When a person only encourages himself, we call him a bragger or proud. And when a person only rescues himself, we call him a coward. If you only look out for you, then you are a herm, H-E-R-M, someone who helps, encourages, and rescues me. Herms are the villains in all of the good stories. They have what's necessary to save the world, but only want to save themselves. They have all the qualities of a hero, but they choose selfish over selfless. Focusing on me doesn't make one a good hero. It definitely doesn't make for a good leader. Solve problems. Everyone has problems. If you ever wonder why you have problems, do the following. Check to see if you're breathing. If you are breathing, then you'll have problems. That's the only requirement. People who aren't breathing don't have problems. Problems are a normal part of life. To live a life that is free from problems is not normal. Problems occur for a lot of different reasons. They typically fall into one or three categories. You cause them, someone else causes them, or they cause themselves. Leaders aren't afraid of problems. They may not like them, but they don't fear them. Problems are a leader's job security. If there weren't any problems, we wouldn't need you to be a leader. Leadership starts with you when you do the hard work necessary to solve your own problems. But when you take the next step, when you realize that leadership is not about you, you actually start looking for ways to assist others in solving problems as well. A leader's perspective toward problems is the first step toward actually solving a problem. Right perspective gives you a better chance at right solutions. Without the right perspective, the progress of your team can be halted and conflict can easily escalate. Noted psychiatrist and author Theodore Rubin said, "The problem is not that there are problems. The problem is expecting otherwise and thinking that having problems is a problem." One of the ways to figure out your perspective is to ask yourself, how do I feel about problems? How you feel about problems impacts how you face problems. Before you start to solve a problem, you need to understand your perspective of the problem. Your perspective basically boils down to two choices. You can see problems as obstacles to be avoided or opportunities to be embraced. Your perspective is your secret weapon. It's also the number one determining factor towards your ability to solve problems. The words, "I can't," are typically a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you view your problems as walls too big to climb, they probably will be. But if you see problems as opportunities to grow, change, think, flex, and work together, you have conquered the most difficult part of the problem-solving process. If you don't see problems as opportunities, you'll see them as obstacles, and you'll be tempted to implement one or all of the following flawed strategies. You'll run from the problem, or you'll ignore the problem, or you'll complain about the problem. None of those strategies will help you accomplish the very thing we need you to help us to do as the leader, solve the problem. All of the great inventions in our world came about as a result of trying to solve a problem. Advances in science, cures for disease, technological breakthroughs, and the birth of nations were the result of problem solving. The problems were the doorway to opportunity. Take a minute and look at the following chart. A wrong perspective will choke you while a right perspective will challenge you. Which perspective do you have? A right perspective says problems are solvable. A wrong perspective says problems are unsolvable. A right perspective says problems are temporary. A wrong perspective says problems are permanent. A right perspective says problems are a part of life. A wrong perspective says problems are not a part of life. A right perspective says problems make us better. A wrong perspective says problems make us bitter. A right perspective says problems challenge us. And a wrong perspective says problems control us. A right perspective says problems stretch us. And a wrong perspective says problems stop us. As a leader, you set the tone for the way your team will approach each problem. The way you describe and talk about problems demonstrates the perspective you want each member of your team to possess. Leaders aren't surprised by problems because a leader is prepared for them. Part of your preparation for problem solving will be developing the right perspective right now. Leaders develop the right perspective before problems occur. Here are five questions that can aid you in your preparation. They won't necessarily solve your problem, but they will shape your perspective about the problem. They will get you thinking about the way you handle problems, as well as your approach towards solving them. Number one, what do I need to do differently to solve this problem? If anyone knew something about problems, it was Albert Einstein. He said, "We can't solve problems by using the same kind of thinking we used when we created them." Einstein knew that something needed to change if the problem was going to be solved. For Einstein, it meant changing his thinking or perspective. If there is a problem, something needs to change. Start with yourself. Number two, what do I need to do to be the right kind of person in the midst of this problem? This is a character issue. You may not find an immediate solution to your problem. You may not have control or influence on what's causing the problem. You may not like what the problem is causing. Whatever the situation, the one thing you do have control over is yourself. In most cases, problems and crisis have a way of exposing who we really are, but they also provide an opportunity to deepen and strengthen our character if we are focused on it. Allow the process of working through a problem to be an opportunity to truly see what you're made of. Number three, what is keeping me from solving this problem? If you ask this question, you might quickly discover that it's your perspective of the problem that is in your way. Or maybe it's the way you've identified the problem. The point of this question is to identify the obstacles that keep you from being a problem solver. Number four, what will solving this problem make possible? This is a vision question. Sometimes people won't solve a problem because they have grown comfortable living with the problem. This question gets you thinking about the opportunities that are out there if you didn't have this problem standing in your way. This is a great question to ask those around you who are hesitant to change. It can encourage people to tackle a problem for the purpose of a better and brighter future. Number five. What kind of story do I want to tell a year from now about this problem? History is full of case studies on the different ways people handled their problems. This question encourages you to work through your problem in a way that can teach and train others who may face similar difficulties. One of the saddest stories you can tell is a tale filled with regret. How would you feel if a year from now you're facing the same problem because you failed to do something about it right now? That's a depressing story. Learn to face your problems with an eye toward opportunity. Set an example for those around you by modeling the right perspective towards problems. Those problems are the very reason why your leadership is necessary. The handwritten thank you note. I am on a crusade to revive the handwritten thank you note. In a world of texting, email, Twitter, and Facebook status updates, the handwritten thank you note has become somewhat of a relic. But this old-fashioned symbol of gratitude will make a profound difference in the lives of those around you. They are remarkably personal. When someone receives a handwritten note from you, they immediately know you took the time to write specifically to them. It's easy to copy and paste emails or text, but when you pen a handwritten thank you note, it contains your personal gratitude DNA. Handwritten is original every time. Your penmanship, as sloppy as it is unique. Your writing is your own. When you send a handwritten thank you note, you offer a word of encouragement in a way that no one else can. A little more time and energy makes a huge impact. Handwritten is more meaningful than typed out because it's rare. People hold on to them. I've seen handwritten thank you notes I've written show up on people's bulletin boards. I have a file folder myself that I keep of encouraging notes that have meant the world to me. These things have a long and strong shelf life. They convey a sense of relationship as well as gratitude. A handwritten thank you note tells someone else that he or she is worth the extra time. It conveys a higher level of sincerity and significance. Will you join me in my crusade? It's easy. Buy a bunch of blank index cards and jot an encouraging note to one person each day this week. You can easily knock this out in 5 to 10 minutes each day. You can hand it to them, but it's even better if you mail it. Receiving a handwritten thank you note in the mail is the stuff of legends. Go the extra mile. The ability to truly serve another person is more powerful when it occurs freely and not out of obligation. It happens when service flows out of a true desire to serve another person. It is when a person serves, not because he or she has to or needs to, but because that person wants to. This type of service expects nothing in return. The act of service becomes a gift this person is giving to another. I believe this is exactly what the principle of going the extra mile is all about. The phrase going the extra mile, or the second mile, originated from the Bible in the first book of the New Testament. The specific passage is the words of Jesus instructing a group of people gathered on a hillside to do the following. Found in Matthew chapter 5, verse 41, it says, "If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with them 2 miles. This is not simply a challenge to get more exercise. It's a subversive command to help a powerless people see that they have all the resources they need to make a difference in the world. In the days when this passage was written, Roman law dictated that a person was required to carry the pack of a Roman centurion for 1 mile. Most of the time, those required to carry the pack were from the parts of society that were continually oppressed and disenfranchised under the rule of Roman law. They were forced to carry the centurion's pack for a mile because it was the law, and they knew they had to do it or risk death in their disobedience. The law was strict. When a person came to the end of 1 mile, he or she was under no further obligation. At this point, the Roman centurion would release the person from having to carry the pack, because he or she had fulfilled what the law required. It is at this precise moment where the idea of true service became more powerful than the law. If a person chose to carry the pack of the centurion for an extra mile, this person did so out of freedom, not obligation or coercion. It was unexpected. It was countercultural. It changed the entire dynamic of the situation. Suddenly, the person who chose to carry the pack went from inferior to influential. It was his or her willingness to serve beyond the obligation of the law that proved more powerful than power itself. While the current culture of our day looks a lot different than it did in first century Rome, we have an opportunity to be the kind of leader who is willing to go the extra mile for those around us. The challenge is for us to figure out how to engage in those opportunities where we can serve others because we choose to believe that's the best way to lead and live with each other in this world. If you're a leader and you want to be a good one, your job is to help those around you to be good at their job. This doesn't mean doing their work for them. It means helping them get the resources and the information they need for them to perform their own jobs as well as they can. It also means watching their back and helping them fix mistakes when they make them. The more you do that, the more you offer your help because you want to, the more you will earn their trust. So when you need them to go the extra mile for you, they will, gladly. Not because you're their boss, but because they respect and trust you. So the question is, how can you serve those around you in a way that demonstrates you want to, not because you have to or need to? How's your serve? Most people who serve in a leadership position got there through an election or selection process. But that process isn't enough to make someone a leader. A person must also go through a reflection process. In order to do what a leader does, you must learn to think like a leader thinks. Learning to think like a leader is similar to the work a detective does at a crime scene, always looking for clues and aware of the little things that can make a huge difference in how things turn out. Sadly, there are more leaders who want to lead because of what they get rather than what they get to do. Leadership is not just about leading, it's about serving. True leaders show up to give, and when circumstances require them to give more than they ever thought they would have to, they do so willingly. As we're getting near the end of this book, I'd like you to invest some reflection time. Leaders who serve because they want to have prepared their hearts and minds to respond in this way. We can all benefit from an honest assessment of our attitudes and our actions in relation to serving those around us. If we only serve others when we feel like it, we let our fickle moods and attitudes dictate our ability to lead our people. If we only serve others when we stand to benefit, our people will see through our disingenuous actions and will damage any trust that we've built over time. However, if we serve our team with the right attitude and with actions that are focused on them, we'll earn our teammates' trust and loyalty, and we'll model the true meaning of servanthood. It's time for the gut check. Take a look at each of the following statements. You'll rate each one on a scale of 1 to 10. 1 signifies that you do this poorly. 10 signifies that you do this extremely well. Your attitude towards serving. The statements are as follows. You take action even when you don't feel like serving. Your mood for the day doesn't affect your desire to serve others. You believe all individuals are deserving of your service. You have the confidence to humble yourself and serve others. You are willing to serve even if no one will notice. You plan to serve without the expectation of the favor being returned. In regards to your actions in serving, the statements are as follows. You are open to serving others even when it will inconvenience you. You are willing to take risks that will benefit others but won't benefit you. You first consider how your actions will impact your team before you consider the impact on you. Leading your people comes before getting your work done. You model servanthood in a way that encourages those around you to serve as well. Take a minute to reflect on your responses. What can you do to improve in one area today? What will it take to rate yourself one number higher? Greater than 1. Every time I'm tempted to try and do my work all by myself, I'm reminded of this statement. 1 is too small a number for greatness. When you are all by yourself, the only person you can lead is yourself. I hope you will start there. I've seen too many people in leadership positions self-sabotage their efforts because they didn't do that part of leadership well. Leadership truly does start with you. But if you want to do anything of significance, it will take the effort of more than one person. It will take a team of people who are dedicated to heading in the same direction, striving to get from here to there. That effort will also require leadership. And leadership isn't easy. You probably already know that. In fact, since you've made it to the end of this book, here's what I think is true about you. You already know it could get really difficult, but you choose to put yourself out there anyway. You've got something inside of you that is stronger than any obstacle, opposition, or struggle. You actually believe you can make a difference. You want to lead because you can make things better. You love people and you love your organization. You have what it takes to do something meaningful and significant in the lives of others. You have an idea of a better future and you want to include as many people as you can in achieving it. In every difficult situation, you are able to focus on what's most important. It's your dedication and drive and desire that motivates you through the obstacles and pushes you forward. If this was only something you did to build your resume, you'd be out the door at the first sign of trouble. This isn't about awards or accolades or personal glory for you. It's not about being able to boss others around or get people to like you. You want to lead because you want to give back and you want to move forward. Leadership isn't for everyone, but it is for those who step into it for the right reasons. Those who do it for the good of others and for the good of their organization will be much better equipped to weather the difficulties. Those on your team and the people around you want you to lead well. They want to get from here to there. They also hope you'll be the type of leader who puts the needs of we ahead of the needs of me. They want you to guide them by serving them. They are ready to give their energy to a leader who says, "Follow me. I'm right behind you all the way." Your team is watching how you live and lead through the paradox, leading yourself first, but not making leadership about yourself. As you model this through your attitudes and actions, you will earn their respect and admiration because you choose to lean into selflessness and not selfishness. Leadership isn't about having a title near the top of an organizational chart. It's not about holding a position of power over others. It's about setting the best example of what it takes to move a group of people from here to there by focusing mostly on others and only minimally on yourself. Don't call yourself a leader. Work hard to ensure that everyone feels like they're working with you and not for you. When you consistently serve the needs of others with the right motives, then you'll be recognized as a leader. That's because leader isn't a title you give yourself. It's an honor given to you by others. You've listened to the audio version of the book, Leadership Is Not About You. For more leadership tools and resources, please visit timmilburn.com. To find out more about what it takes to lead yourself well, to lead others well, and to live your life with the perspective of a lifelong leader.